You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Black History Month is celebrated every year in the United States during February. Idaho's Black History Museum will be focusing on how lawyers have advanced social causes in our country. Joining me live in studio to talk more about this are Philip Thompson, Executive Director of Idaho's Black History Museum, and Attorney and Executive Officer with the University of Idaho, Mike Satz, who will be the featured speaker this weekend to kick off Black History Month. Welcome to the program, both of you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
So tell me why, Philip, you decided to really focus most of the month on law during Black History Month this year.
I think for the vast majority, people neglect to realize that it's the law is the strongest institution used to either keep a people down or to push people ahead. And then we can get into whatever discussion we want as far as what needs to be done. But if you've had legislative actions taken against a given people to keep them a permanent second-class citizen, no matter what you do, nothing's going to change. And so that single reason is what held black people back for so long. We've only had, 40 years of being legal equals in this country, and then people wonder why we haven't been able to catch up. Well, this is the reason why.
And Mike, for you as an attorney, but also in the education field, how does this play into all of that?
So part of the things we're seeing that are going on in our country right now, in current events and things like that, are that people don't really understand some of the civic rules that we live by and the system that we live in. And it's really important that people understand that we live in a civil society, and that's a civil legal society, and it's designed to, you know, we have laws that are in place, we have judges that decide on different laws and different facts and that sort of thing, and that's all designed to empower the rule of law, and it's the rule of law that gets us to places where we want to go. You know, you hear a lot of people say, "Oh, well, you know, you're just making, you're just using law to do some kind of activist kind of thing," and you know, all of law is designed to reach some sort of result, right? It's all designed to reach a policy result. So even something as benign as the tax law, right? The tax code is designed to encourage certain behaviors and discourage other behaviors, right? And that goes all the way through the criminal law, through contract law, every kind of law. It's designed that way. And people just don't seem to understand that.
And then when we look at the social justice part of it and certain laws, certain cases that have made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes.
We would not be, I mean, I would argue to say we would not be where we are in this country if certain cases had not come in front of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Absolutely. You know, when I teach my students about this in law school, I explain to them, you know, there's a lot of frustration, and often people of color are very frustrated. And they focus their frustration often on white people. And I explain to them, you know, it was white judges in the South that started all of this, making things equal, right? It was very brave white male judges who said, this isn't right, and this is the Constitution isn't being appropriately applied here. And they're the ones who actually started that happening, and that went up through the system. But as Philip said, it wasn't until Brown v. Board of Education that we had the first statement of, we really need to start treating everyone equally here. And that was the very first time. That was the beginning. And there were still many, many, many cases that were really watershed cases all the way through the 80s, really, that changed the way we approached things. But now we're starting to see a backlash against that. And we're starting to see a lot of people say, oh, well, these judges are being activists and that kind of thing. And really, they don't understand what's happening.
Speak about this idea of activist judges.
Sure. So a lot of times when a judge decides something that you don't like, they say, oh, that's an activist judge. Right. So one, judges don't make the law. Right? Judges interpret the law given a set of facts, or they decide whether the law should be valid or not based on the Constitution. Right? They don't actually make law, except very rare circumstances in the common law. But that's not what normally people are angry about. What they're angry about is a case didn't go their way, and so they call that judge an activist judge. The irony of it is people on one side will say, those judges over there are activist judges. And then they insist on judges coming in to decide cases their way. And so they're actually insisting on the exact same thing that they're saying they don't like. And what we need is we need impartial judges. And the vast majority of our judges are impartial judges. And that's why it's somewhat disappointing that people don't understand how the system really works. And you want an impartial judge deciding things. So that's how the rule of law works. If you have judges deciding things on one side or the other side, then what you end up getting is a system that actually no one has any faith in.
And Philip, what I think is interesting about what Mike said is that people, I think, as you said, is so many people do not understand truly how the legal system works and how it is supposed to be applied. So I think one of the great things you're doing this coming February is how you're incorporating kids into some of your exhibits. Talk about that.
Well, I personally have a 7-year-old and love my
Me
daughter.
Too.
Love my daughter more than life. And so she's kind of like my sounding board for anything and everything. And so in order to get her to take any interest in what we do at the museum, you have to appeal to their level. So for like the exhibits we have on display about like Japanese internment, mm-hmm. Citizens United, we made a comic version of them as well. Simplified pictures, a much more, you know, cut and dry 2 or 3 lines explaining what the case involved and how it was rectified. And that way somebody, even as simple as a 7-year-old, can understand and get the basis or get the idea of, okay, hold on. These are important cases, and this is why. Number one, it's visually intriguing because it's a comic, so you can always get their attention, as opposed to boring them to death with this, you know, intellectual, legal scholarship. Then they're not going to spend more than 30 seconds listening to.
What? That's not boring.
we need to get them engaged, because there was a study that came out last year that said that if you don't reach kids by grade 4 and convince them they're capable of going into arts such as the law, philosophy, et cetera, mm-hmm. they cut it off and they don't consider themselves thinkers and they won't study it thereafter. So you're going to end up with a dearth of kids who aren't going into philosophy, law, medicines, chemistry, because you have never appealed to them on a level to make it interesting. So that's part of what we're trying to do, is just bring it to them at their level in a way that it's appealing and let them see how even something as simple as a rule at school mm-hmm. isn't an arbitrary decision to hold them back. It's similar to what we do in society. It's a law used to keep society safe and treat everybody equally and impartially. And once they can make that connection that, oh, okay, my parents also have rules we have to follow. This isn't just the mean adults treating us poorly. So we made a comic to go with that as well, to understand, to explain to them that, hey, the rules instituted in your household and in your school are not just to control you. They're in order to bring about the best end result for society. We do the same thing there with adults. They're called laws. And it's just a way to kind of bring what they're experiencing to what is and kind of help them see that.
I'm speaking with Philip Thompson. He's the executive director of Idaho's Black History Museum, and Mike Satz, executive officer with the University of Idaho, as well as an attorney. And Mike, you'll be speaking at, this is basically the kickoff event this Saturday for Black History Month at Jump in downtown Boise. Your presentation, it's titled Law, A Tool of Social Engineering. What does that mean? What are you hoping to get across with this on Saturday?
What I'm really hoping to get across is to educate people on how the law is used to achieve policy gains, and that is the social engineering piece of it. And I will talk all the way back to biblical times to show how we've been doing this for a very, very long time. But then I also want people to understand that it's not about activism, and it's not about liberal or conservative, right? It's about principled application of the law. And then I will finish it by explaining how culture plays in to some of the changes that we need, and how today we're seeing culture that is not keeping up with some of our legal norms. And that's actually causing a lot of this mm-hmm. conflict, and why we still have to pay attention to everyone. And we still live in a civil system where we still have to engage one another, even if we disagree. And that's something that seems to be missing and lacking. And when that happens, that really does weaken the rule of law, because that weakens the respect for law, that weakens people's desire to enforce law and that kind of thing. So it's kind of all of that wrapped into one very quickly.
Very quickly.
Yes, very exciting presentation.
Of course, because you're not going to bore people like Philip said. Philip, it's interesting that you said that when we look at the civil rights movement, that many of these laws, I mean, 40 years, maybe 50. You're right when you say that is not a long time. And then then you wonder why our African-American community has not caught up on so many levels. That's a pretty profound statement when we think about our history as a nation.
Well, I saw the funniest, not funniest, the most mind-opening, simple picture that showed, like, from the 1619, the first arrival of the African slave in the East Coast, to the amount of time they spent in bondage, to the time they spent as second-class citizens, to the time that they were legally held back, to the time they finally got equal representation in the law, which we could discuss all day whether or not that's even happened today. Mm-hmm. That's only been a fraction of the amount of time that we've spent here. And then you couple that with the socioeconomic disempowerment, with poor schools, redlining, any legal maneuver that was done to keep them second-class citizens. It's not neuroscience or rocket science. Tell me what other group of people were able to overcome in this amount of time when the system was actually devised to keep them down. And so in keeping with that, we're going to a display that's going to come up during Black History Month that's from the New York Historical Society, talking about Black in the Age of Jim Crow, because it's the same principle. I guess you've been released from bondage, but you're still not afforded equal status. Mm-hmm. You have the same thing going on now in society with whatever group you want to name that are being held back simply by the fact of what they are. It's like, oh, you're not one of us, so therefore we're not going to let you into the party. That is a way to keep a people permanently second class. And until you can really rectify that, address that, and bring them up to the rest of the group, you're never going to get anywhere.
How critical is it in the time that we are in right now to be going back and frankly discussing a lot of these laws that were implemented 40, 50 years ago? Because as you said, Mike, I mean, we are so divisive as a nation right now. Is it almost like just showing the foundation again?
Yeah, it's very important that people understand the history behind this. And again, when you listen to people on various sides of the issue talking, one thing comes very clear is they don't understand what happened and how we got here, nor do they actually understand what some of these laws say. So some people say, oh, well, I'm not going to get this job because I'm white. They're going to give it to a person of color. Mm-hmm. And then that's actually not how the law works. The law works. It says you're supposed to advertise a job to try to get as many people as you possibly can from as many backgrounds as you can. But then you still choose the person who's best qualified based on that. But that's not what people understand. And so they really don't know what the background is that led to all of this. They don't understand how when criminal law was not applied to white men in the South, when they lynched black men, that that led to a basically a reign of terror for a century and a half or a century, you know, and they don't understand all of these things and why we have these laws in place. So it's very important to understand the history behind it and why we're doing what we're doing and why we got where we got. And again, this lack of education, this lack of civic knowledge is really causing a lot of damage to the national discourse and really honestly to our nation as a whole. And we need to start working to remedy that.
And the event is this Saturday, Jump, downtown Boise. Tickets still available for folks to come.
Yes,
correct, Philip?
Yes, ma'am.
I want to thank both of you for coming in today and talking about this. My guests, Philip Thompson with the Idaho Black History Museum and Mike Satz with the University of Idaho. Thank you so much.
Thank you, ma'am.
Absolutely. Thank you.